And one was a 12-year-old young man who had come in from Las Vegas, and he was having his first psychotic break. And his mom had left him, and his dad was a single dad raising him. And his dad was a Cadillac used car salesman from Vegas. And so he fit all those stereotypes. So I was at UCLA, and I was in my training, and my little office was so small. I had a folding chair that when I opened the door, I had to fold the chair, and then we'd close the door and then put the chair down, and then the dad could sit there. And I got to tell him what was going on with his kid. And remember, I was really smart. I had gone to med school and I got into UCLA, which was the best place. And so I'm telling this guy about neurotransmitters and dopamine and acetylcholine and psychosis. And I'm really smart. And our daughter at that time had just been born. She was a few months old. So this is about 24 years ago. And the dad looks me in the eye and he says to me, "Do we need to build a room out back?" And I started crying. And I realized that I wasn't smart, that actually the most thing I'm going to learn is from listening to my patients and their families, and that the trajectory in this family's life had changed dramatically. And this guy knew much more about being a dad than I did as a new dad. And he taught me that you got to talk in plain language and you can't hide behind our medicalese. You got to engage with families and you got to be real.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to do that for my patients or patients that I'm now responsible for ever since. I think that's one of my biggest drivers.
There are certain people who possess the natural ability to inspire others. The way they engage you, tell moving stories, and make you want to work with them to achieve great things comes from a place of intelligence and genuine compassion. Dr. David Feinberg is one of those people. When he took over as president and CEO of UCLA Health, patient satisfaction scores were abysmally low, especially given the caliber of medicine being practiced there. Leading by example, Dr. Feinberg painted a picture of what great patient care could and should be, and his amazing team at UCLA bought in, eventually transforming it to where it is today, one of the top five medical centers in the country, if not the world. Now president and CEO of Geisinger Health in Pennsylvania, Dr. Feinberg continues to practice what he preaches, still rounding with patients and even implementing a refund program for patients who are unhappy with the care that they received. He also continues to innovate, leading Geisinger on a journey to incorporate genetic testing to help care for those predisposed to diseases. Gavin and I left this interview feeling inspired, and even upon re-listening to it during the editing process, I found myself feeling the same sense of hope that with leaders like Dr. Feinberg, we can lift America's health delivery system to great heights. At times both funny and empathetic, we hope you enjoy this episode as much as we did and leave ready to take on the challenges you face in your own operating realities. We also hope you're enjoying our weekly release schedule to start the summer. Last week's episode with former Home Hero CEO Kyle Hill was far and away our most downloaded episode, and stay tuned next week for a great conversation with CAPG President Don Crane. Be sure to follow us on iTunes in the podcast store or on Stitcher so you don't miss an episode. We'd also appreciate if you could like and comment on Pop Health Podcast so that we can continue to attract more listeners. You can also find us online at pophealthpodcast.com and find me on Twitter at pophealthzach. I'd love to connect with you there. As always, thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Dr. Feinberg, we are in kind of your old territory up in Beverly Hills. How does it feel to be back?
It's amazing how much traffic and how crazy people drive. So when I first moved back to central Pennsylvania and you're at a stoplight and you're going to make a left turn and the light turns green, the guy coming the other direction doesn't go. And I can't figure out what it is. And they're waving at me. And I think they're angry at me. No, they actually allow you to make your left turn before they go through the light. Wow. And it took us a few weeks to get used to that, where then I was driving around with my son last night. I'm like, people are crazy here. So your homeostasis changes when you get back into different types of environments. And And the traffic blew me away here in the last few hours.
Yeah, I would imagine. We also talked about a little bit of difference on restaurants here from where you are before. And I would imagine weather too. Do you miss the Southern California weather or do you kind of like having seasons now?
So we had our first, or I had my very first snow day. So there was a big snowstorm a few weeks ago and you couldn't get out to work. And I was like, this snow day stuff is fun. You just do emails at home, drink hot chocolate. I'm like, and shoveling snow, I had no idea what a great cardio exercise it is. And we actually get quite a few admissions to the hospital for chest pain during big snows because folks go out and shovel. And it's too much exertion. So those were new things for me as to learn. And it's been fun. So far, it's been a great novelty.
I have never had a snow day. Gavin, have you ever had a snow day?
I have not. My niece lives up in the mountains here, but it's definitely a rarity. I'm familiar with shoveling dirt, but definitely not shoveling snow. One thing I found interesting when we greeted David this morning is he already had a meeting. And for those of you listening, we're recording this podcast very early in the morning, probably
pre-7 a.m.
Yeah, yep. Pre-7 a.m. Pacific time. But David came in from the East Coast and already had a meeting this morning on East Coast time. So you were up
about 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock. Yeah. So you slept in.
So I slept in. Yeah, exactly.
Well, David, thank you so much for sitting down with us. When we start each episode, we always like to ask our guests, can you tell the audience something that they might not know about you, something maybe outside of the work sphere?
Yeah, so I think probably what folks don't know, and I finally have come to grips with, is that I'm not going to be a professional basketball player. But that's been my dream all along. And the closest I ever got was I was able to play Kobe one-on-one. I lost 1-0. It was a very short game, but it was the highlight of my professional basketball career.
And you actually got to play Kobe?
Yeah, I actually got to play Kobe one-on-one. Man. Yeah, and he double pump faked, and I kept thinking, he does it again, don't jump up. He did it again. I jumped. He shot. He looked me in the eye. He said, it's going in. Yeah. It went in. Then I went against him for one shot. He just stood there with his arms up. I got the shot, a fall away off over him. He said I had nice form and my shot didn't go in. So that's probably, so that dream now is over. I guess that was as close as I got.
That's a lot closer than a lot of people. I have to say, there's a lot of jealousy coming from my microphone right now because that is an amazing experience to get to play with Kobe Bryant. And he told you you had good form.
Yeah.
So most people don't get to hear that.
Where does your loyalty lie with basketball?
So, you know, moving to the East Coast, I'd say there's two things that really bum me out. Other than that, this has been amazing. I really, really miss the avocados. So you don't get good produce in the same way you get it here year round. And the other thing is my sports teams are on too late at night. So I grew up in San Francisco. I'm a huge Warrior fan, a huge Laker fan. I don't mind being a little bit of a bandwagon fan. So watching Warrior game starts at 10:30 at night there, I can't pull it off. So I tape it. And then, you know, of course, my dad sends me a note or something. Wasn't Steph Curry great last night? And it ruins it. I've tried to shift to some sports teams back east, but I still like my Niners, despite how bad they are. I like my Warriors and I still like Pac-12 athletics too. So was rooting for UCLA and even USC and, you know, or Oregon and all that kind of stuff.
Well, we can edit out the part that you were rooting for USC just so all of your UCLA colleagues don't get too upset. You actually have multiple board certifications as a practicing physician. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience as a clinician?
Sure. So I'm trained as a psychiatrist, and I have also did a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry, and I also did added qualifications in addiction psychiatry. So those three areas I ultimately got board certified in. Most of my practice clinically was child psychiatry and adolescents with substance abuse. So child psychiatry is ADHD, autism, depression, anxiety, and teenagers with substance abuse is a different beast than adults with substance abuse, but I still practice. So at Geisinger, I still see adult patients, and I also see children and adolescents.
You actually beat me to my next question to ask if you do still practice. What is that? What does your practice schedule look like now? Obviously, you've got a full business work schedule. So how often do you get to practice? What does that look like?
So, you know, when I meet with my executive team every week, I call that group therapy, but they're not officially patients. I would say my practice schedule is, you know, once a month for a couple hours, I do some adult psychiatry, and once a month for a couple hours, I do some child psychiatry. So pretty limited.
Do people know that they're getting the bigwig when they have you as their physician?
So I don't think I'm the bigwig. I think that I really haven't stopped working to be a healer. At Geisinger, we're really fortunate to have 30,000 people that get up every night, every weekend, every holiday, every snowstorm to come to work. And I think I'm one of them. And so I'm really the big wig in our organization are the patients that trust their lives to us and their families. And then the organizational chart would be those that are providing direct care to them. And probably the lowest guy on the totem pole when I'm doing that administrative stuff is me. And I really see myself and my team's job is to support those above us that provide incredible caring and kindness to our patients.
Excellent.
Well said, David. So shifting over to your time at UCLA, while currently you were the president and CEO at Geisinger, you were president and CEO at UCLA for many years previous to that. And how did you initially connect with UCLA and what led your eventual position as president over there?
Yeah, so I wanted to be a child psychiatrist at a med school. And the two best places in the country to get trained in child psychiatry at that time were UCLA and Yale. And my wife was a year behind me in medical school. And so we thought we need to find a big enough city so if I get my training when she comes, there would be opportunities for her in internal medicine. And New Haven didn't have as many opportunities as LA, but growing up in San Francisco and my wife from New York, we hated Los Angeles.
Uh-oh.
So the thing was we would come to LA for our training and then we would leave. We didn't have kids at that time. We thought it would be a terrible thing to raise kids in this godforsaken, you know, place. So we came to UCLA or Los Angeles temporarily. And okay. I think really had not the Geisinger opportunity come up, that was 25 years ago, we probably would still be in LA. And we ended up raising two nice kids with nice values. So we were wrong. LA was a great place. But that's what got me to UCLA was to get the psychiatry residency, which increased your odds of then later getting a child psychiatry fellowship. And that worked out. And then I was going to leave. But my wife had a great fellowship at Cedars-Sinai in pulmonary critical care. So we thought, well, we'll hang out another couple of years. And the last thing I wanted to do was work in an academic medical center because I thought they're slow and clunky and not cost effective. Not that I knew these words back then. But I needed a job as opposed to opening a practice because we were leaving. We were always leaving. And then it just kept going and my job got better and her job got better. And we're like, well, this is great. And we found great friends and loved Los Angeles. So I guess it was a little bit by happenstance that we came here for training, but our plan was always to get out of here.
Okay, and then while you were practicing, what drove you to be a leader and kind of move up the totem pole?
Yeah, so I would say there were two patients that were really important to me that formed my identity as a physician and I think as a physician executive. And one was a 12-year-old young man who had come in from Las Vegas, and he was having his first psychotic break, and his mom had left him, and his dad was a single dad raising him, and his dad was a Cadillac used car salesman from Vegas, and so he fit all those stereotypes. So I was at UCLA, and I was in my training, and my little office was so small, I had a folding chair that when I opened the door, I had to fold the chair, and then we'd close the door, and then put the chair down, and then the dad could sit there. And I got to tell him what was going on with his kid, and remember, I was really smart. I had gone to med school and I got into UCLA, which was the best place. And so I'm telling this guy about neurotransmitters and dopamine and acetylcholine and psychosis. And I'm really smart. And our daughter at that time had just been born. She was a few months old. So this is about 24 years ago. And the dad looks me in the eye and he says to me, do we need to build a room out back? And I started crying. And I realized that I wasn't smart. That actually the most thing I'm going to learn is from listening to my patients and their families. And that the trajectory in this family's life had changed dramatically. And this guy knew much more about being a dad than I did as a new dad. And he taught me that you got to talk in plain language and you can't hide behind our medicalese. You got to engage with families and you got to be real.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to do that for my patients or patients that I'm now responsible for ever since. I think that's one of my biggest drivers. And another was, again, nearby, there's a public school around here called Warner School where my kids went to school.
Yeah.
It's about a half mile from UCLA. And this little girl in third grade, this was a few years later, she writes in her haiku poem that she wants to tie yarn around her neck and kill herself. And
wow.
This is before cell phones and all that stuff. So the next day, after the teacher read it the night before, she calls the principal calls the mom, they call the dad. And because they knew people, okay, these were connected, it's totally back to kind of LA, they were able to get in to see me in 3 weeks because they were in the know. Yeah. And what that taught me, and she did really well.
Good.
What it taught me was if your kid is suicidal and says they want to tie yarn around their neck in the haiku poem, or if your wife has a lump in her mammography, or if your elderly parent falls in the middle of the night and is bleeding in the bathroom but waits to call you in the morning because they don't want to disturb you, you want care today.
Yeah.
And so they taught me about access. I didn't know that word, but it's not who you know. When it's your kid, you need it today, or your wife or your mom or dad or husband or whatever. So I've been working on improving access kind of in their honor. And they represent the connected people. Those that aren't connected have even more difficulty with access. And so those were some early things that I think have just driven me about, let's get people in and talk to them in simple language and help engage in their care.
Well said. So use the term access, David. And one thing that I learned and early on in my healthcare career was the term hardwiring excellence, which was actually from a book by a healthcare leader, Quint Studer. And one of the things that great leaders did was walk the floors. And at UCLA, you walk the floors. And I wanted to see, is that something that you still see as important to do for your leadership, whether it's yourself or other teammates?
Yeah. So the way that happened, I would say, was somewhat accidental. It's now, it's hardwired in any organization I'm part of. The way it happened was I was running our psychiatric hospital half-time, and half-time I was a clinician educator at UCLA. And the guy who was running the entire UCLA health system left unexpectedly. And the dean said to me, literally, if we did a search right now for a real CEO, no one would come because our new building is delayed. We got no money. We can't make payroll. So would you do this job for a year till we move? And then we do a search and we'll get a real guy. And so with that vote of confidence, right, I said, yeah, I'll do it. So, and he was right. I wasn't the right guy for the job. If you looked at my resume, I that was skipping like four grades, going from a $40 million psychiatric hospital to, at that time, UCLA was about a $2 billion organization. And a lot of people came up to me those first few days and started asking me questions. And they were questions that I couldn't answer because I didn't even know the language, right? I knew Ritalin and Adderall, but they were asking me how many bunkers go in the MOB and what's the start time and the block times in the OR. And I didn't know what MOB or bunkers were. Yeah. So really hard questions to answer when you don't even know the nouns, right?
Yeah.
So I felt most comfortable sitting on patient beds and listening to what was going on. So I spent probably 2 to 3 hours in that first 100 days with patients in parking lots, in waiting rooms, in recovery rooms, in intensive care units. And one of my mentors had said, you know, in this new job you just got, Dave, as an interim, pick one thing that you're going to focus on and try to move the needle in that. And so that kept going in my head, and I kept listening to these patients and UCLA. Now, remember, I just knew the psychiatric hospital. I was now down in the medical hospital and the multiple medical hospitals. And what I learned was we performed miracles where other people didn't. We did more organ transplants, and I think they still do, than any hospital in America. And outcomes were the best in the country. Amazing stuff. The other thing I learned was, despite that, you know, the hot food wasn't hot, the cold food wasn't cold. Our patient satisfaction, I didn't know that was even a metric, but yeah. 2 out of 3 patients that I met were thrilled with their new liver, but they couldn't wait to get out of here because the discharge process was screwed up, or the nurse wasn't available, or the doctors weren't communicating well. So after that first few months of listening to patients, it was a great experience. I said, well, we're going to focus on taking care of the patient. And when I said it, I don't even think anyone was listening. I mean, because remember, I'm an interim. They'd had customer service before. They got a coffee mug when they did the training, or a t-shirt. Like, what are you? You're a psychiatrist. What the hell's going on here? And with a few champions, we got some wins. And it turned out to be an incredible story of taking an academic medical center that was world-class in quality and making it not only world-class in quality, but world-class in caring. And I just kept spending 2 hours every day seeing patients. So currently my schedule is in central Pennsylvania is where we're located. We have our big academic center there, but we have 13 hospitals throughout our area and about 216 clinics and helicopters and more urgent cares in Pennsylvania and New Jersey than anyone else. So I say I only want to be in town 2 days a week. And when I'm in town 2 days a week, I only want to spend 2 hours a day of those days in my office. So I guess that means I'm only in my office 4 hours a week. Those other hours, I want to be out in our main campus seeing patients. And then those other days when I'm not in the central area, I want to be on our other facilities talking and listening to our patients. So the ability to connect with our patients is a real privilege. When I went to business school in 2000 or 2002, which was a great time because every guy in my business school class was rich because of the internet, and then the dot-com bubble burst and they all became consultants.
Oh, yeah.
And what they kept asking all the time was, who's clicking? Who's coming to our site? They so badly wanted to know who their customer was. And I kept thinking, whoa, I know my customer. They're upstairs. We've taken away their dignity by giving them a robe that doesn't close in the back. We're giving them food that isn't warm. We're not speaking to them in a way that they understand. I can learn everything I want. I just got to go upstairs. I mean, literally upstairs, and I can know every one of my customers. So that's what got me out and about originally. It is certainly hardwired. We now round at Geisinger. I think we're going to call Guinness Book of World Records. We have a once a month leadership rounding that has about 500 folks. All of my board of director members make rounds now. It's a requirement to be a leader at Geisinger to be out and about and seeing patients.
That's excellent. So you round quite a bit. You're in your office 4 hours a week.
Yeah, that's the goal.
So you must have a lot of champions in your organization. You mentioned at UCLA, champions get things done. And you must have a lot of great champions at Geisinger to get all the great work that you've done, because you're meeting with people, speaking with people. Tell us a little bit about your team.
Yeah, so I really, really believe in this is a team-based approach. It's a complex organization. I think President Trump said it's more complicated than anyone knew. I think we kind of knew how complicated it was. And what I want in my team is brutal honesty. When I got to Geisinger, I asked the team right away, which one of you is going to take the role of, you know, saying, hey, that's BS, Dave, you're wrong. You know, yeah. I need the one. I talked about at UCLA when I went from, I was at the leadership table for psychiatry. And when I got that interim role as head of all of UCLA's clinical operations, and you move to the head of the table, you know, like your jokes get funnier, but you didn't get funnier. People just, they just like you more, right? Or they're kissing your ass more, whatever you want to call it. So I need brutal facts, brutal honesty, and brutal feedback. And so to create that culture, I think is really important among the leadership team and then throughout the organization. And, you know, it's assumed that you will come with competency in your area. But really what I look for in teammates is integrity, passion, and humility. You know, humility, when we screw up, people die. So let's really be clear about what business we're in. The integrity, both UCLA and Geisinger are these places that have great brand names in healthcare.
Yeah.
Let's not screw it up for the next guy. And then the passion. I mean, I think we have a completely dysfunctional healthcare system. And I'm passionate, and I want teammates that are passionate about, let's disrupt it ourselves to make it easier for patients to get care, to make it more understandable, more affordable, higher quality, more convenient. You know, let's bring in normal things that are done in other businesses, but for some reason never happen in healthcare. Let's be the disruptor. So I need that passion. So that's what I'm looking for in teammates.
Before we get too far off of it and just dive fully into your experience at Geisinger, you got to give a TED Talk during your time at UCLA. What was that experience like? As a big fan of TED Talks, I definitely enjoyed watching yours. What was that whole experience like for you?
It was totally bizarre. So I had never heard what a TED Talk was. I just knew I was given a talk at UCLA on a Saturday afternoon, and it was hot here in LA, and we were swimming at the pool at home. And so I went to give some talk at UCLA, and the audience, there was this packed audience. I never heard of what TED was, and there's this packed audience. And they were really, really engaged, right? So you'd say something, and I was like, whoa, these folks are into it. And then I wanted to get back home. We had little kids, and we were playing in the backyard. But there was this pressure that you had to stay. Like, when you're done, you got to go to this front row seat. And then this next guy gets up, and he's this guy who delivers packages in Los Angeles by bike to lawyers, like a package delivery guy. And he brings his bike up on stage and he's talking about the meaning of life, you know, by driving a bike, whatever they're called, Fitzies or whatever they are, without brakes or something like that. Right. And almost getting killed. I'm like, what the hell's going on? And then he's talking about his bathtub and he saves the water in his bathtub and he takes it outside to grow the plants. And I'm like, where the hell am I? Like, well, why did I just talk before this guy? And like, what's going on?
Right.
And then I learned what TED Talks were. And people are like, whoa, you gave a TED Talk. And my kids are like, Dad, your TED Talks just got played in my class in college and all this stuff. And I'm like, I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew you had to be done in 18 minutes. They made that really clear. And then I was upset because I usually don't have like perspiration in my armpits, but it was this hot day and I just come from swimming. And I was like, wow, if I knew this was an important talk, I would have, you know, I would have dressed differently. I would have done a lot of stuff differently. So I did a TED Talk by mistake.
Yeah, well, I would encourage people, especially if you enjoy TED Talks, to check it out because it's very easily digestible and it is a great talk. One thing that you mentioned in there is that even when you had gotten UCLA up to the 99th percentile in patient satisfaction, that I think you actually said that it sucks still because that meant that only 85 out of 100 people were still satisfied. Do you think that it's realistic for an organization, especially of that size, to get even higher than that in patient satisfaction, or will there always be some level of dissatisfaction that's there?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Zach, I didn't get UCLA to 99th percentile.
They're
great folks at UCLA. I did very little brain surgery my time there. We did. And 85 out of 100 people in healthcare, if they give you a yes, you're in the 95th percentile. And that means 15 out of 100 people, despite coming to UCLA at that time, which was the place that discovered the first case of AIDS, you know, came up with Herceptin, which is probably the most precision-based cancer treatment in the world, wouldn't refer us to a friend. Like if you were in manufacturing and you had 15 defects out of 100, you'd be out of business. So why do we accept that?
Yeah.
So I don't want to be the best in healthcare. I want to be the best in caring, period, right? I don't want to be better than the DMV. I want to know you better than Amazon, right?
Right.
So, and I met with those people. I mean, right, if you're rounding, I know those 15 people that didn't give us that good score. And I would say as a psychiatrist that one of those 15 typically is truly crazy. Like they want a brain transplant for their husband and we don't do it. The other 14 are regular moms and dads and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and grandpas. And we screwed up, not because their expectations were unrealistic, but rather because we didn't communicate or coordinate care.
Yeah.
And they deserved it as much as the 85 that got it right. So maybe you can't get to 100, but you better get to 99. And 85 is not 99. 85 is good in healthcare, but 99 is good in human care.
Right.
So, yeah, we're not satisfied with being better than the DMV or being better than, you know, that hospital down the block.
Sure. Now, your work at Geisinger is an integrated health system, correct? So can you describe for the audience what that means and what that entails?
Yeah. So it's the ideal platform to try everything. So we got anything you want and we don't have any of the bad stuff.
Yeah.
So we have about 2,500 employed providers, docs, nurse practitioners, PAs, 30,000 employees altogether. We care for over 1 million unique patients in multiple hospitals and clinics. So that's like our provider side. We're also an insurance company. We have a $2.5 billion insurance company where when you talk about risk-based payment, we're getting all the money to take care of these people and we're responsible for them. And then we have a lot in education and research. So we have about 1,000 medical students and residents, and some very focused research in genomics. And we have markets that we own. We have markets where we're not the owner, the number one in the market. We have ones where we got employed physicians. We have every potential permutation in healthcare. And that type of integration, that type of, if you do the right thing for the patient, it's going to help one part of our business, allows you to do things that you can't do in other places. So if I could give you some examples, we now take diabetics that are food insecure, meaning these are our patients, but they are worried about how they're going to pay for food this month, or they've skipped food last month because of money and their diabetes is out of control. And we've said to them, come on in and we'll give you free food for your entire family for the week, every week, with instructions on how to cook it. And, you know, if you live in a motel, you get a hot plate and a spatula and a microwave. And we're going to make your type 2 diabetes go away. So 100% of the patients we've enrolled have had a decrease in this thing called hemoglobin A1C, which is your blood sugar over a period of time.
Right.
Decrease in weight, decrease in medication use, decrease in cholesterol, decrease in smoking. The typical patient, one guy named Tim, we spent as a healthcare insurance company $220,000 on his care for 4 years before he was in the program.
Wow.
We look back 4 years. He's been in the program this year. We spent $1,200 on his care. So not only did we prevent amputations, end-stage renal disease, blindness, neuropathy, impotence, we just saved, I guess, $219,000 or $218,000.
Yeah.
And the only other side effects are the rest of his family is not going to get diabetes. His sex life is going to improve. And he says, now that he knows how to cook tilapia, he thinks it's a good pickup line and he's going to start dating again.
Right.
Now he's 6'7", about 475 pounds.
Yeah.
And he's a looker now that he's lost about 40 pounds. When you do that in an integrated delivery system, one, it makes you feel really good. But let's talk about it from a business standpoint. We just saved $200,000+.
Absolutely.
If you're just a provider and you do that, you just eliminated the ability to do amputations, end-stage renal disease, neuropathies, and blind retinopathies,
yeah,
which are drivers of your business. So for us, it allows us to do the right thing, and it works out for us financially. Many people are familiar with Kaiser. Kaiser is integrated and closed, and we say we're integrated and opened. And what we mean by that is Kaiser doctors see Kaiser patients with Kaiser insurance in Kaiser facilities.
Yeah.
That describes Geisinger for about 50% of our business. But the openness is we have contracts with Blue Cross, Aetna, United. You can come to a Geisinger facility without being a Geisinger insured patient.
Oh,
and we also sell Geisinger insurance in places where we don't have clinical assets.
Okay.
So we have 60,000 non-Geisinger employed providers in our network.
Oh,
so you could be in Eastern Maine and have Geisinger insurance and not see a Geisinger doctor. What we do, the coolness of this, the thing that attracted me is in that sweet spot where we're like Kaiser, where we're totally integrated, we innovate.
Right.
And when then we take that innovation out to the outside. So if as an insurance company, if we don't have providers there, we say, here's how we want you to do it.
Yeah.
And if we're a provider and it's with another insurance company, we say, here's how we take care of diabetic. Now pay us so it'll work the right way. So,
yeah,
so we kind of have this test lab, which is 50% of our business. And then 50% of our businesses try to fix it in other kind of places.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool.
We we hear that frustration quite a bit, especially in the podcast with people that we talk to about having these solutions that could work, but it takes spending a little bit of money to hopefully save a lot of money, just like your example with Tim. Do you feel that you have more flexibility to do that in the way that the health network is set up? Do you have a little bit more flexibility? You mentioned innovation. Do you have a little bit more flexibility to innovate than you would in a traditional health system?
I would say it's actually a requirement to have this kind of structure or a relationship if you're a provider with a health plan that allows you to do this. We take congestive heart failure patients with CMIs of 2, meaning you'd get paid a lot if they came to the hospital. They come to our ER and we say, we're going to admit you to home. And we take them home with paramedics. They're treated for 3 or 4 days and, you know, diuresed at home with paramedics, and then we discharge them from their own bed back to their own bed at home. And so that avoids a hospitalization. That's hard to do if your chief financial officer is saying, what is our inpatient census and why did it drop?
Exactly.
For us, it's great to do, and then we want to backfill with appropriate cases. So it allows you to do these things really, really quickly and to fail fast if it doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, one of the innovation parts that I wanted to ask you about, can you explain a little bit about the it's proven experience, right? That program that you have. Can you explain that a little bit for the audience?
Sure. So the proven portfolio started at Geisinger long before I got there. So 10 years ago in heart surgery, we were the first to say, if you have heart surgery at Geisinger and you have a reinfection or a readmission, there'll be no charge. So it was basically bundled payments that people talk about now.
Sure.
The New York Times called it the first warranty in healthcare. That proven acute, it went from a lot of types of inpatient acute procedures to proven home navigator, which was making sure that all kinds of chronic illnesses were treated appropriately, and world-class results. When I got to Geisinger 2 years ago, our anticoagulation went from best in the United States to best in the world. And that was because we had proven how you do it. And the way you do it is you take that away from docs and put pharmacists in clinics and have them manage that. And so all that had happened. And when I got there as this kind of patient experience voice, I said, well, why don't we put it all together? Why don't we have a proven experience? And the experience would be, answer the phone on the first ring. We'll give you a same-day appointment. We'll treat you with kindness, compassion. It'll be dignified, culturally sensitive care. Your transitions will be smooth. We'll send you a bill that you understand, right? We're the insurance company, so we can get rid of those EOBs that nobody understands.
Right.
And at the end, we'll refer you. You'd refer us to a friend. And if not, you know, we're all about this warranty that we had there for a while. We'll just give you all your money back. No questions asked. So we launched this program in a pilot phase about a year and a half ago with our bariatric surgery and spine surgery patients. It went well. So now over a year ago, we said, okay, it's for anyone. And we got an app you can use to get your money back, or you can just ask somebody, or actually they will probably ask you. So yeah. We go looking for problems. And we think we're the only healthcare system in America that says if there's a problem, tell us, we'll apologize, we'll fix it for the next guy, and we're happy to give you anything back you want. And so we've refunded over $1 million in the last year. It's been phenomenal. I think our patients are great secret shoppers. They tell us where things are good, where things are bad. And they also, I don't think we've been ripped off once.
Yeah.
So typical examples are, you know, come in the hospital and had bariatric surgery and all the docs were nice, the nurse was nice, blah, blah, blah. But here are the complaints. And the complaints were the IV hurt for a few hours, you couldn't fix it. One nurse wasn't kind and there was noise in the hospital and we said it'll be over at 9 at night and went till 10 at night. And this person on the app could ask for $2,000. That was the out-of-pocket for bariatric surgery, and ask for $150 back. And we say it's a no questions asked. We do ask two questions. We ask your name and address so we can send you the money. It's been great for us. And we think, I don't think it's innovative. You know, you go to Starbucks and you don't like the latte, or they made it with almond milk instead of soy milk. I've never seen the barista sip it and give it back to you and say, sorry, you have to drink it.
That's the LA in you, the almond milk.
There you go. That's what they do in healthcare, right? We sip the latte and we say, no, you got to drink it. I'm sorry. The MR machine's down. I'm sorry. Well, sometimes we don't even say, I'm sorry. You know, we were oversold last night. There's no bed for you. I mean, crazy that we don't have that same kind of service mentality. And this isn't about giving patients extra oxycodone in the ER to get your scores up. Yeah. This is about giving patients the care I'd want from my mom. And if that's what you're doing and we failed, then we need to fix it. And so that's been our proven experience program. It's been great. We think it's fantastic.
Do you think that, obviously it's worked very well for you in the way that your system is built. Is that a sort of idea that could be expanded? Do you think that that's an idea that could be utilized by other healthcare systems or rolled out more universally? Or does it work specifically because of the way that your system is set up?
I think warranties are effective in two types of places. One where you know your stuff is really good, nothing's going to happen, so who cares if we give a warranty? Or you got a reputation, maybe deservedly, that your stuff is bad and you need to tell the consumer, we fixed it or we stand by it, right? So Jaguars are really cool cars, but you know, my dad always wanted one. And when I was growing up, they always would break down. So they were the first one to come with a 5-year warranty because it meant, oh no, we fixed our problem. Even if they didn't fix it, it gave you kind of that peace of mind. So in healthcare, when we do spine surgery, when we do heart surgery, I think we fall into that category of, we really know how to do it the right way. We've been doing it for a long time. Walmart now sends patients from 22 states to us where they say, if you need spine surgery and you get it locally, you're going to pay 50% of the cost. If you go to Geisinger, it's free, right? So we know how to do it. That's the warranty there. The warranty on the whole aspect, the proven experience part, the nice part of care, I think we're the opposite. And I'm talking us in healthcare in general. It's always screwed up. Yeah. So by saying we give a warranty, we're really saying to our staff, let's really fix it. Let's get patient focused and let's learn where our mistakes are. So that's what I think. So I think it would depend on each organization where they are.
Sure. Sure. And yeah, the willingness of people to participate in something like that, especially some of the other insurance companies. I've noticed a lot, both in my research for the episode and also as we've talked today, you reference a lot of outside companies. We just talked about Starbucks. You mentioned the Amazon experience earlier. Do you utilize a lot of ideas and creative thinking from companies and organizations that are outside of the healthcare system? And how are you able to integrate some of those customer experience ideas into healthcare when they're not necessarily from healthcare?
Yeah. So I think healthcare is ripe to be disrupted. We're a growing percentage of GDP. If we continue to do what we're going to do, America will only produce healthcare. We'll have no schools, no defense, and no streets. I mean, we literally will just be, and our outcomes suck. I mean, we're not even good for how much we spent. So some Stanford dropout, likely in a black turtleneck, will disrupt our entire business with a cool app or something. It's going to change it. And I keep saying, we got to be the ones that change it. And then when you start looking at those kinds of other places that have been disrupted, it's about much better engagement with customers and consumers, right? I mean, when we talk about any of these cool things, you got to do it. The last thing I want to be is Kodak or Blockbuster, right? Or the taxis or whatever it is. And when you look at those disruptions that came into those businesses, it was taking a lot of friction out of getting those services. And that's just a video, or that's just getting a ride from A to B. When you get a cancer diagnosis, when you got hit by a truck, when your kid is born with a congenital heart disease, there's so much friction in your life from the disease, the disorder, the lack of health. Then we put on top of it this dysfunctional system that causes, in some cases, more pain than the underlying disease, right? We make people go bankrupt over this stuff. Right. Whoa, what an opportunity if we can say, let's get rid of all that noise and make it as easy as Airbnb, right? Yeah. And we still got to do the good care, but all those friction points make it go away. So, and Geisinger, in a conservative part of the country, has always had that in its DNA. Let's figure out how to do it differently. It's an amazing kind of dichotomy, I think, and it's so much fun. It fits with the way I see things.
Excellent.
I like, I always hear the term path of least resistance, and you talk about friction. So I see a lot of similarities there, and it seems like you've removed a lot of the barriers, and you mentioned access to care.
Yeah, but I would say let's get really honest here. I think my job is to close our hospitals because no one should ever be in the hospital. Yeah. We're starting to change our outpatient centers to, not only do we say, hello, nice to see you, we apologize that you had to come in because that means our home monitoring failed. Like, no one wants to go to the hospital or no one wants to go to the doctor. I have a beautiful relationship with my banker and my travel agent, and I haven't seen one in 10 years, right?
Right.
And, but for my doc to get a refill on my meds or to get in, and you know, you got to come in, and even when I think there's huge opportunity to look at other industries and say, how can you be my doc, understand me better? And I mean, my Wells Fargo app now, right? I don't even need my card to get money out of the ATM. It's like, you know, it's, and when you look at other things that young millennials are doing with Venmo and with ways and social media to connect and crowdsource, you know, why aren't we offering an insurance product that's really cheap for millennials that says, we'll give you extra money for your insurance if you sell some of your data de-identified because it's valuable, right?
Right.
And if anyone gets really sick, we all agree we'll crowdfund it. I mean, there's just ways to say, let's tap into a whole new way of thinking about this.
Right.
And, you know, in central Pennsylvania, the Amish folks don't have insurance. But when someone gets sick, they all give money and take care of them.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa, that's crowdsourcing and it's community. And they drive a hard bargain because they're paying cash. I'm like, whoa, why aren't we doing this kind of stuff? So I just think other industries have a lot to teach us. The technology and the advancements in healthcare are really phenomenal. The process really sucks.
Yeah. I know in Zach, in my day job, if you will, we have shifted our thinking to realize that industries or individuals outside of what we were doing might bring a lot of value to us. And that took a while for us to shift that thinking. And we've seen huge successes. So I definitely agree, David.
Yeah, I'm inspired. Thank you so much for sitting down with us. I know that you've got a busy day. Like we mentioned, you've already been up and working, and we're taking you from your workout. Maybe not with Kobe Bryant, though, today. But in all honesty, thank you so much for sitting down. This was really enlightening. I know that the audience is going to enjoy it. I certainly did. Gavin, again, it was great having you back together, got the team back together.
Yeah, it's great.
It's been a little while.
Also, I just wanted to do a shout out. Thank you to the folks at Geisinger for allowing us to have time with you today.
Absolutely.
And also, Zach and I have special places in our hearts with UCLA Health System. So we know you did quite some great work out there. And just again, really appreciate you coming out, David.
And Absolutely. We appreciate you being willing to talk about both systems very much, because we know the audience will enjoy that quite a lot. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, guys.
Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.